Jobs Day Friday doesn't get any better than this, does it? Well, it does, but I'm a business journalist from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal, March the 10th, Friday, as I said. Glad, as always, to have you along, everybody. The headline goes like this: 235,000 new jobs in this economy last month, 4.7% on the unemployment rate. Peeling back the layers of the onion? Well, that's what the next 5 minutes and 15 seconds are for. David Gura is at Bloomberg. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. They are both in our studios in New York City. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Lee, let me start with you. Find me something bad in this jobs report, right? Because generally, good.
I can do that. It was really good.
Can you really?
It was really good. Okay, one thing, if you want to really nitpick, So wages were up 2.8%. Like, that's really good, and that's a continuation of a trend we've seen.
That's year on year,
right? Year on year, yeah, but it's not inflation adjusted, and inflation was up 2.5%. So there's your negative.
Okay.
Many positive things. Participation rate up 63%. That has trended down across the board, a pretty solid number.
David, your thoughts?
No, I would agree with that. I'm looking at the wage growth number as well. We heard from a lot of Federal Reserve policymakers last week. It was like a bonanza of policymakers speaking before this jobs number that came out today.
You have got to get out more.
Yeah, well, you say we're business journalists. But, all of them said that they were looking for this wage growth figure. And we heard from Stan Fisher, the vice chair in New York, last Friday. And he remarked on the fact that over the last 3 months, the numbers, the metrics have been pretty solid. I think today was just confirming that.
I was going to save Janet Yellen for the end, but there's no doubt, David, right, that the Fed raises next week?
Yeah, she spoke in Chicago last week after Stan Fisher. She sort of had the last word of all of these policymakers who spoke, and it seems like she's going to use her Fed speak to say so. But we're getting close to those two mandates, inflation mandate and the employment mandate. She seems pretty content with where we are. And you just look at this reversal in Fed funds futures, which is a very wonky thing.
Could you get
bets,
God,
bets.
Man, don't do that.
You actually worked here at one
point,
rates.
And now you're doing it.
I know. Oh, it's so sad. What's become of me? But that indicates really that we're going to see a rate hike here next week, a two-day meeting, and we'll get that maybe Wednesday.
Lee, yeah? Same deal.
Yeah,
right?
I agree. At this point, the market expects it. And the weird Fed expectations thing, if it didn't happen, there would be a huge negative reaction, I think, at this point.
Oh, my gosh. That would be terrible. All right, Lee, so I can't even imagine that. The healthcare bill. Must talk about that. And, Lee, I want to ask you something. The Republicans are pushing this through without what is known as CBO scoring, the Congressional Budget Office, which we looked at Monday and Tuesday of this week. Mm-hmm. Is the CBO score on this bill going to matter for its eventual fate, do you believe?
I think it still will. I mean, it's really significant. I mean, these are economics, mm-hmm. economists and statisticians. This is a nonpartisan. I think it still will.
David, what do you think?
No, I'd agree with that. I mean, we've had other organizations score this thing already, and they've indicated that a lot of people are going to lose coverage, that this is going to have an adverse effect on the deficit. Obviously, that's going to make it more difficult for the Republicans who back this thing to get it through. I'm struck just talking to people about the bill who are in the medical industry, who are affiliated with political groups, how few people seem to favor this piece of legislation. You had Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, yesterday literally rolling up his sleeves, standing in front of a PowerPoint trying to sell this thing. I think that's going to be really hard work for him to do that. It's not a sure thing that this is going to pass the House. They're trying hard to move it through quickly, which is why you see them sort of going around this CBO score to start with. Mm-hmm. But I think it's no certain thing.
Well, Lee, I was going to ask about that Paul Ryan thing, because he was giving a seminar on this bill, selling it essentially to a bunch of Capitol Hill journalists. I mean, it's not like he was talking to anybody else out there.
Right. No, that's true. But I think, everybody knows that you can't. It's not so easy. This is not easy to do. There's a reason why. I mean, it's just not going to be possible to do everything that this bill needs to do. And that's why you have things like Jason Chaffetz saying that, you're going to have to choose between the iPhone people love and healthcare, which is such an incredibly condescending and patronizing thing to say. And rightly got a lot of heat for that.
All right. So looking ahead to next week, beside the Fed, David, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin sent a letter to Congress this week that said, I'm going to have to take extraordinary measures starting on Wednesday if you don't raise the debt limit.
We're here again.
So we're here again on that. Also, the White House said today that the president's budget proposal is formally coming out on the 16th. It's going to be a busy day. And the question really is, A, we're here again on the debt limit, but also the budget. We don't expect anything different than his outline, right?
Yeah, the Senate Majority Leader has said that he expects the debt ceiling to be lifted. We'll see the usual back and forth, political back and forth, I'm sure. And we get more detail on the budget. Still not the full thing yet. I mean, there was still such fierce opposition to some of the things in that really broad outline that we had a couple of weeks back, especially when it comes to defense spending on Capitol Hill. I think that that debate is only just beginning.
Lee, does the economic disconnect among Republicans, both on the budget and on the health care bill? I mean, there's so much going on where this party does not agree with itself. Does that surprise you at all?
Not at all. I mean, I think it speaks to the larger, just incredible conflict within the party. So, no, and I think that's going to be one of the most interesting things to watch as all this stuff starts to play out.
Going to be an interesting week next week. Lee Gallagher, she is at Fortune Magazine, and David Gura is at Bloomberg. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, have yourselves a great weekend. On Wall Street today, up, then down, then up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We are, as economists like to say, or some of them anyway, within spitting distance of full employment in this country, where everybody who wants a job can pretty much find one. And where, if you try to push the unemployment rate a whole lot lower, things start happening. Things like acute labor shortages in some industries, spiking wages, and then not entirely in control inflation. That's a bad thing. But spitting distance isn't all the way there. There are some people here who could and want to work but haven't yet found a job. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman at our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting to find out who those people are.
Millions of people left the workforce altogether in the Great Recession, and nearly 8 years later, some of them are still sitting on the sidelines. Others who lost jobs or had their hours cut are still having trouble finding full-time work that they're qualified for, says William Rogers, chief economist at Rutgers University's Workforce Development Center.
You're less educated, you're less skilled in an industry that's contracting, that is facing intense competition from abroad in manufacturing and other sectors that have been outsourced.
Rogers says African Americans are still unemployed at twice the rate of whites. Young people are underemployed overall. Another group, he says, has struggled to get back into the labor market.
Moms in their 20s and 30s, full-time working with their children and raising their children, many of those women are, I think, also having challenges, especially in IT or those sectors where the shelf life of those skills can atrophy very quickly.
Meanwhile, as the labor market continues to tighten, employers are having a harder and harder time filling job vacancies. Bill Ravenscroft is with national staffing firm Adecco. He says employers are starting to go after non-traditional targets. For instance, he's working with a manufacturer that is recruiting
folks that have been working in the hotel industry and housekeeping or landscaping. This is unskilled labor who do not possess the education needed for the jobs that they're being hired for.
He says it's now worth it for companies to provide that training with a longer onboarding period to get these workers in the door and on the production line. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Here is a somewhat existential economic question. What do you suppose is the oil industry's biggest challenge? And if you said low prices, uncertain supply, or market volatility, I'm sorry, but no. According to the CEO of Royal Dutch Shell, who it's fair to assume would know, it's public acceptance of those oil companies, trust that they understand their social and environmental responsibilities. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
If we're not careful, public support will wane. That's what the CEO of Royal Dutch Shell, Ben Van Beurden, told an oil confab in Houston. He said Shell is putting $1 billion into renewables, and that board member pay is linked to climate goals. John Hoffmeister, ex-president of Shell U.S., says the company has learned the cost of losing public trust.
Whether it's the accusations in Nigeria of environmental despoilation, whether it is going back to the 1930s and the fact that it had a CEO who was a national socialist, these lessons are what every executive at Shell knows about.
When things go wrong, companies can lose drilling permits and be targeted by activists, says Patrick Heller of the Natural Resource Governance Institute. It's a watchdog group.
There have been large-scale protests to block access or prevent the projects from operating. There's a real impact on the bottom line of these companies.
You might think oil firms would be optimistic under the pro-fossil fuel Trump government. But for global companies with long timelines, one political cycle in D.C. is just a blink. Oil exec Ed Herz teaches economics at the University of Houston.
The change in the administration is not going to change the direction of science or the direction of the climate. And these corporations understand that in 4 years there'll be another president, and they have to plan ahead.
He warns if the president doesn't lead, companies that know what's good for them will have to. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We told you late last year about French authorities demolishing a migrant camp in the northern port of Calais, the jungle it was called, right at the French end of the channel over to England. But since that camp was destroyed, dozens of unaccompanied children have left the centers that were set up for them by the French government. They are sleeping where they can, and they're still trying to smuggle themselves over to the UK on trucks, lorries, as the Brits call them. Turns out those risks might be for nothing, as the BBC's Zoe Conway reports now from Calais.
I'm at an industrial estate on the edge of Calais, close to some woods. And there are about three dozen teenagers here, most of whom are from Eritrea. And these teenagers are psyching themselves up to board lorries tonight for the UK. For many of them, this is a nightly ritual. So you're from Ethiopia?
Yeah.
How long have you been in Calais?
In Calais, almost 2 months.
And where are you sleeping?
Under a tree or in a bridge or so.
Or under a bridge?
Yeah.
And are you trying to get to England?
Yeah, every day try, also today also try, but it's difficult. I have family, two sisters there.
We're just walking through some woods following about 10 Eritrean boys. They're going in this direction to try and get on some lorries. And they've come this way in order to avoid the police who often patrol this area. And they're now running across the road, making their way into the lorry park. It's utterly brazen. It's extraordinary.
They can hide underneath of the axles.
Adrian is a Romanian lorry driver who regularly passes through Calais on his way to Britain.
Sometimes on the top, if he's busy here.
And what do you feel about these kids?
Well, I feel sorry for them, but, you know, I feel sorry for me as well because, you know, is my life in danger? Just happens like a month ago. They blocked the road, actually, and they tried to get me the lorries and everything. Yeah, it was about 15, 20 of them, like.
Local charities estimate that there are more than 300 unaccompanied migrant children in this region of France. Some have drifted towards the Grand Centre refugee camp near Dunkirk, which volunteers told us is now controlled by smuggler networks. The camp is squalid and has become so unsafe that many of the women, they're too scared to leave their huts to use the toilet.
The camp is dangerous. I'm scared of the smuggler people.
Abdul, which is not his real name, is from Afghanistan. He looks young and says he's 13. He's living here on his own.
One night in the camp, I saw two Kurdish men fight each other. One had a gun. He hit the other man round the head, and it was bleeding.
Abdul used to live at the Calais migrant camp. From there, he hoped to be taken to Britain under the DUB scheme for vulnerable children. Now he tries to get to the UK on lorries. The British government has closed down the DUB scheme. How do you feel about this happening?
I'm very sad about it. We were told we would go to England. I don't like France. I want to go to England. I want to go to school.
I spoke to Abdul through the charity Safe Passage, which helps children to get to the UK legally. Laura Griffiths is their senior field manager. So the Calais camp closed last November. What happened to a lot of the children there?
A lot of the children were taken to accommodation centres, thinking that they would be eligible for this scheme and go safely and legally to the UK. And this hasn't happened. And they're ending up in places like Dunkirk camp, which are extremely dangerous, and they're at risk yet again.
That report was from the BBC's Zoe Conway in Calais, France. Coming up.
Maybe I'm in a different country and I have to go for an emergency visit and I don't really want to spend 4 hours filling out paperwork.
Don't blame you, but Bitcoin might be the answer. First, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 44 points today, 0.2%, 20,902. NASDAQ up 22 points, 0.4%, 5861. The S&P 500 rose 7 points, 0.3%, ended at 2372. Some weird alchemy of the jobs report and waiting for Yellen probably is what's going on there. For the week, the Dow slipped about 0.5%, the NASDAQ down 0.1%, the S&P 500 off 0.4%. Energy stocks flagged as oil prices fell. Marathon Oil trickled down 0.5%, Hess Corporation off 2%, ConocoPhillips dipped 1.75%. Today, chip makers, however, clicked up. Get it? Clicked up. Applied Materials put on 2%. Broadcom edged up 1.9%. Intel inched up about 0.25% today. Beauty products retailer Ulta brushed up 4.6% after posting sales and earnings that beat analysts' expectations. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.57%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Six undergraduates from Wake Forest University are in New York City this weekend with money burning a hole in their pockets. They're on a buying trip for the Student Union Art Acquisition Program, just like it sounds. Art for the Student Union on the campus down in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Devin Gilbert's a senior at Wake Forest. He's a business and art history major. Devin, it's good to have you on.
Thank you for having me today, Kai.
Tell me how this whole thing works, man, because it's wild.
Yeah, so Wake Forest has, since the mid-60s, had an art collection that's curated entirely by students. So every 4 years, the university sends students up to New York with funds from the university to collect contemporary art that represents our time.
How much money do you have to play with this year?
We were given around $100,000.
Okay, so the university gave a bunch of college kids $100,000 and said, go to New York and buy some art.
They made sure we were well prepared to do it.
So what are the qualifications? They have to be art history students. What else?
You actually don't have to be an art history major. Uh-huh. There are some course requirements, but it's actually open to students of any major.
And you all get to decide. There's no university sort of professors standing there saying, "Ooh, I don't know about that one."
We have a faculty advisor, but she's here mainly as a facilitator. It's our decision in the end. We've looked at around 120 different artists, and we cut it down to around 22 to look at when we came to the city.
So what's your favorite? What's going in the door? What do you want to bring home?
I think one of the most interesting things I've seen is work from an artist named Feig Ahmed. He's from Azerbaijan and does textile-based pieces, sort of based on motifs from traditional Azerbaijani carpets. But we have to decide unanimously what we want to purchase.
That's tough.
Yeah, so tonight and tomorrow night, it's going to be about deliberating and us deciding what we want to bring home.
And once you all decide on a painting, it just gets shipped home, I guess? Or a piece of art, it just gets shipped home?
We'll go back to the gallery. There is some room for negotiating price and shipping and framing and things of that nature. But yeah, it'll be shipped back from New York to the university by an art shipper, and we should have it within a couple months.
Once you found out about this program, how long did it take you to decide, yeah, I want to be a part of that?
I actually heard about the program while I was still in high school. It was one of the things about Wake Forest that interested me. So it's been a goal of mine for the last 4 years.
And you graduate in the spring, right?
Yes.
And then what?
I'm looking for jobs in the art world, in sort of the business of art up here in New York.
So this is good. This weekend's a little networking, right?
Yeah.
Good deal. Devin Gilbert, he is a senior at Wake Forest University. He's a majoring in business and enterprise management and art history. He and a bunch of his friends are on an art buying trip in New York City this weekend. Devin, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bitcoin hit a record high today. The virtual or cryptocurrency, as it's sometimes called, traded at almost $1,300 a piece for a spell this afternoon. One of the great virtues of Bitcoin, one of the selling points, if you will, is the security apparatus underlying it, something called blockchain. And it turns out privacy and security are valued in other parts of this economy as well. Your medical records, for one. From KERA in Dallas, Lauren Silverman explains.
We all remember the old days when doctors thumbing through paper records was standard fare on TV drama.
The lab report on Ellen Farley, doctor.
Doctors mostly look at records on computers, but the same problems exist. The records from your eye exam, your blood test, they're not connected. Even worse, they're saved on central servers, so they're easy to hack. Now imagine instead, all those pieces of digital paper are torn apart and encrypted. You need a code to see any single piece. Then the pieces are uploaded into a peer-to-peer computer network. For a doctor who has permission, those digital pieces, they come together like a puzzle. That's blockchain. Right now, the digital currency system Bitcoin uses blockchain to track financial transactions. Folks in healthcare want to use it to encrypt and share medical information.
So your data, pieces of data, is spread around all over the network.
Venkatesh Hariharan is CEO of Health NextGen in Dallas.
So if I get even one piece of it, that's not good enough. It's useless. How many places are you going to hack?
There's a lot of hype around blockchain in healthcare at the moment. Greg Harris just spent a week at the health tech industry's largest conference demonstrating how his company's product, Patient Wallet, would use blockchain to give patients more power over their health records.
Maybe I'm in a different country and I have to go for an emergency visit and I don't really want to spend 4 hours filling out paperwork. So all I do is I ask the hospital for their identification and I delegate access to all of my healthcare records, or at least all the ones that I want to give them.
This instant access to electronic health records does raise legal questions, especially about sharing data outside the U.S., but it would mean less paperwork and lower administrative costs. That's why major companies, IBM, Philips, Merck, all have blockchain initiatives. Even the U.S. government is interested. Stephen Posnack directs the Office of Standards and Technology in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
We're inviting teams of people to join together to demonstrate how blockchain can be applied in practice in healthcare.
Posnack says government agencies like the FDA, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they're exploring how the technology could make healthcare transactions more secure.
There's a lot of real interest, but it's extremely early.
Dr. John Halamka manages the IT system of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Halamka, along with researchers at MIT, ran a 6-month test of blockchain in the real world. They used blockchain to see if doctors could easily access medical records for the same patient uploaded from different sites. The prototype worked, and they're planning more pilots with larger networks of hospitals. Halamka says technology isn't the challenge.
We still have a culture where every healthcare provider thinks of themselves as the single steward of the data that is deposited in that organization. So with blockchain, every time I make a change to your data, I am telling the public ledger that the data has changed, and now thinking of it as a more community-wide resource is very different psychology than the past.
In other words, before we use advanced blockchain technology to stitch together our medical records, we should address some more philosophical questions about who owns health data and who can grant permission to share it. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, this morning's jobs report one more time. It came up in White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer's briefing today, as you'd figure it might. We're just going to hit that tape.
In the past, the president has referred to particular job reports as phony or totally fiction. Does the president believe that this jobs report was accurate and a fair way to measure the economy?
Yeah, I talked to the president prior to this, and he said, to quote him very clearly, they may have been phony in the past, but it's very real now.
That's not actually funny. And we are out of here. The Dow up 44 points today, 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 22 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 gained 7. That's about 0.33%. Fed next week. beeps. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourselves a great weekend. All right, we'll see you again on Monday. This is APM.